two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before.
We're talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
David D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. I want to talk about a topic that I think is always timeless. We're talking about Black cinema, in particular, the genre that is known as Blaxploitation. There's a book out, it's called Black Caesar and Foxy Cleopatra, A History of Blaxploitation Cinema, and it's brought to you by longtime film critic Odie Henderson. He's the chief film critic for the Boston Globe and runs a blog called Big Media Vandalism and Tales of Ordinary Madness. He's described as a lover of film noir, musicals, bad art, good trash, and of course, Blaxploitation. Welcome to the show, sir. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me on.
So this is, in my mind, a timely topic. There's a gentleman out here who does a lot of media stuff. Big shout out to Rage Soldier, Wes Hendricks. And he said something a long time ago. We were talking about film. And he said, you know, we're entering a new age of Blaxploitation. And, you know, at first I was like, what do you mean? And he kind of broke it down. And, you know, years later, we're kind of sitting there going, maybe he had a point there. But now we have you with this book and I'm looking at it. Some of it confirms what Wex has said, and delightfully so. You go deep and give a lot of history and kind of break some of the traditional narratives that many of us had. I think when we talk about Blaxploitation, we immediately go to films like Superfly, and here out west, we go to the Mac and we start building from there. And of course, we all mention Melvin Van Peebles' Sweet Sweetbacks, you know, but I didn't realize there was all this layered history before and during that time. And it fills a lot of gaps. So I'm glad to have you on. With that being said, I guess the obvious question would be, what is Blaxploitation? Is it every Black movie? Is it something that comes out at a particular point of time? Does it have to meet a certain set of criteria?
Well, it's very difficult to define. And in the book, I talk about how I think it's like film noir's definition, and that it's not necessarily a movie, it's an era. Because if you look at it, you have Sweet Sweetback, which is technically an action movie slash drama. You have something like Blackula, which is a horror movie. You have Shaft, which is a neo-noir. So this, they cover so many different genres and subgenres. But the Blaxploitation era, in my opinion, the era itself goes from 1970 to 1978. And granted, there are things that are specific to a certain type of Blaxploitation movie, but I think that it's bigger than that. And it's hard to define. It's very kind of squirrely in its definition. But I think there are certain things that would befit a Blaxploitation movie. For example, soundtrack, the fashions, the that there is a Black hero or heroine, and that it takes place in, you know, an area that we would be in, like Harlem, like the Huff, like LA, like Chicago, like Detroit, so on and so forth. But I think it's bigger than just saying, oh, well, Foxy Brown is Blaxploitation and that's it. Or, you know, Pam Grier is Blaxploitation and that's it. Because it encompasses so many different things of that era. I think when you mentioned Blaxploitation coming back, I don't think it actually ever, quote unquote, went away. But I think we can talk about that as we go along. But I think that's kind of, it's hard to define, but I think it's basically the era and the attitude.
With that being said, Odie, do we attach a definition? I mean, you gave your definition, but I think in the minds of many, they would attach a definition that is connected to a political agenda or a social, you know, agenda. So meaning that if I go and see a movie like Soul Train, you know, I mean, Soul Plane, right? Or Snakes on the Plane, I might go, well, that's a Blaxploitation movie. That's something that makes us look bad. And I may take something like Black Panther and say, now that's a good movie. That's not Blaxploitation. Is that fair to kind of have that as a working definition, or is that something that we can see a lot of people, kind of clamoring towards? And I ask this because when we look at least when I've looked at some of these movies that typically come up, say like your Shafts and what have you, I didn't realize or kind of forgot that, oh yeah, there were a bunch of other movies. Sidney Poitier had movies and Harry Belafonte had movies. And with those movies, which may arguably be seen as something that's more uplifting or something that depicts Black folks in a better light, would that fall in the genre of blaxploitation because it's in a time period?
Well, first of all, I don't know if we can say blaxploitation is all bad. I mean,
Okay.
it's not. I think that it gets the reputation simply because we're looking at it from a contemporary lens. And granted, there are movies that have stereotypes in them that are awful that I talk about in the book. And there are movies that have stereotypes in them or it has characters in them that are become kind of canon in terms of when you see Black people on the screen nowadays. So not everything about blaxploitation, in my opinion, the genre and the era was bad. And at the same time, Sidney Poitier was taking control of his career around the same time these movies were occurring. And I talk about that in the book. I talk about when Sidney died, I did a piece on Involture.com called My Sidney Poitier, where I talked about when I got Sidney Poitier, when my mother got Sidney Poitier, and we got say we had the same age when my mother was five, which is when I got Sydney, in my mind, thinking about Uptown Saturday Night. My mother was five. Sydney was in movies like The Black Boy Jungle and in Defiant Ones. And he was the noble Black person because usually he was the only Black person in movies back then. And in the 70s, he started taking control of his career by directing movies, by producing them, by putting good old Harry Belafonte and Buck and the Preacher, for example, and directing that film and being able to do a comedy. Sidney didn't do any comedies before Uptown Saturday Night
Oh, I didn't know that.
because,
Okay.
he couldn't be funny because a funny Black person was a coon. It was someone like Willie Best or someone like, something like that. You couldn't really make a movie where a Black person was in a comedic role and not have it be stereotypically what the old Hollywood system said. Now, with that said, these are exploitation movies. That's why it's got exploitation in the title of what they are. So they're going to have some salaciousness to them. And this, it's not just blaxploitation movies. There are other movies that follow the exploitation genre as well. There's sixploitation, there's haxploitation, there's nunsploitation, there's brucesploitation. All of these things are happening around the same time as blaxploitation. And they have different, for example, hixploitation has Appalachian white people in movies that are similar to something like Superfly. Except they're driving a truck, something like Smokey and the Bandit or White Line Fever. So everybody that was downtrodden or did not get representation in movies got their moment where the representation started out in this type of action slash, this action slash drama kind of thing where it's heightened. Now, again, there are bad stereotypes in blaxploitation movies, but I am not of the mindset that this is all bad at all. And so Soul Plane, to throw Soul Plane and Black Panther at you, back at you, both of those movies had they been made in the 70s, they would have been made very similarly to how blaxploitation movies are made. They were not going to give a Black person $300 million to make a movie. In fact, when they gave Sidney Lumet $12 million to make The Wiz, and it wound up costing $30 million, they basically excommunicated Black people from movies for
Wow.
years, unless you're a Richard Pryor
Right.
or Eddie.
So I'm just thinking, it's a lot there. The term, I guess, has negative connotations in some circles, even though you say not all of it is bad.
But it
And
was designed to be a negative. Julius Griffith coined it as a negative term.
okay. When did that come about? Was blaxploitation something that was named around a particular time when these movies
Yes.
were named? Okay.
And it was Julius Griffin, the head of the Beverly Hills slash Los Angeles NAACP, back in October of 1972. He coined the term blaxploitation. And the reason why he did was because of Superfly. Superfly came out in June of 72 and was at one point the number one movie of the year, of the week. It beat The Godfather. And so Junius Griffin, now mind you, we had Slaughter, we had Shaft, we had Cotton Comes to Harlem, we had Sweet Sweetback, we had Watermelon Man. These movies have preceded August, October 1972. So we haven't had Coffee or the Macaroni, these other movies yet. The movies that really, really are big outside of Superfly, that is. So when he coined it in 1972, it had a much more negative name before that, I won't say. He coined it as a point to say that they're exploiting black people. That's where black exploitation comes from. Exploitation, that suffix has that root, that it means that it's an exploitation of something, whatever that prefix is. So he started that. And then on top of that, the NAACP and CORE also started a coalition against black exploitation in 1972. So people's outrage now is not new. People were complaining about this in 1972 before all the big, some more salacious moves even made. So the term itself was coined as a negative term. So you're correct in that regard. But again, I don't see every single thing about it as negative because before Pam Grier had a gun in her afro, there were no powerful black women on the screen at all.
Yeah.
Not just black women, women in general. Unless you were a femme fatale in film noir, you weren't really, or you're in a Russ Meyer movie, you were not, which is an exploitation movie in its own right. You really didn't see that. You
What
didn't see
about
black people in power.
Cicely Tyson and why am I I'm going blank on her name. She played Julia. You know what I'm
Oh,
talking
to
about.
Diane Carroll.
Diane Carroll, right? I mean, they predate a lot of this, and what about their trajectory? And I ask this because was the NAACP and CORE and other groups, were they looking for a return to those type of characters or pictures that they started?
Well, think about Julia had Fred Williamson on it. Fred Williamson was her boyfriend, and Diane Carroll eventually played Claudine in 1974. And Cicely Tyson was in Sounder, so that was the Sounder was the measurement for the Coalition Against Blaxploitation. They wanted more movies like Sounder. That's what they said explicitly. Now, Sounder and Lady Sings the Blues came out in 72. They both were multiple Oscar nominated pictures, made some black history. Suzanne the Past was the first black woman to be nominated for an Academy Award for writing. I think she may have been the first black person to be nominated, period. Her and Lonnie Elder was nominated for Sounder. They were the first black writers nominated for an Oscar. Cicely Tyson and Diana Ross made history as being the first two black women nominated in the same year. And Sounder, I believe, was up for Best Picture. Lady Sings the Blues, I don't think was. So they were looking for movies like that. And really, Lady Sings the Blues and Sounder were an aberration of movies in general, black or not. You had to wait a very long time to get a movie with black people in it as gorgeous as Lady Sings the Blues.
Right.
So they were, that's what they were looking for. They were looking for those kinds of movies that were just basically, again, this sense of nobility where, Sidney was the noble Negro and he died for the white folks. And, nothing against Sidney Poitier. Obviously, I love Sidney. But those types of movies that were made, you couldn't even have a mustache. Ivan Dixon, one of the rare black people to have a mustache in a movie before Shaft, before Sweet Sweetback. That was 1964. But you couldn't even have a mustache. Even Jim Brown, whose mustache is, an icon, did not have a mustache before Blaxploitation.
Right.
Because black men mustache meant sexual virility, which is ridiculous. But that's how people thought in Hollywood. So you look at that, and then you look at now we have movies where the black guy's a detective and he's the coolest person in the movie. That is either Mr. Tibbs for Sidney or Shaft. Both Mr. Tibbs and Shaft got three movies out of their character. In fact, John Shaft is the longest running black character in the history of American cinema. Played by Richard Roundtree, by the same person, for 48 years. So you look at this, you see, you have this transition between black people having to be noble, with black people being able to be flawed. And that's one of the pluses of blaxploitation, that you got powerful black people, you got some complicated black people. You also got stereotypes, yes, but stereotypes existed, since Birth of a Nation.
If you're just tuning in, that's the voice of Odie Henderson, film critic, so the author of the book Black Caesars, Foxy Cleopatra, A History of Blaxploitation. Usually people like to put folks in categories to kind of better understand. And We often do it in groups of three. If you had to put a big three starting off in the early part of, let's say from 1968 up into 72, who would that be in terms of their impact? Not necessarily actors, but like, for example, I might put Melvin Van Peebles and Sidney Poitier up in there. Who would you put as people that we should pay attention to, as you highlight in the book?
Well, can we back up a year and go to 67? Make it
Sure.
67 to
Okay.
72? So we make it 67 to 72. We have to include Sidney, obviously, because in 1967, Sidney Poitier was the biggest box office draw in Hollywood. It was the first time a black person did it. In fact, Sidney took, he did the Jack Nicholson deal. Well, Jack Nicholson would do it later, where he took a percentage of the gross of a movie he made and took a scale. And that movie was To Serve with Love. And To Serve with Love made an ungodly amount of money and made Sidney so rich that he actually left movies for a hot second and went back to the Bahamas. So we got to put Sidney there, number one. Also, Sidney being the kind of torchbearer of black actors, not because he had and because he wanted to, because he that's what it was. Then you get someone like, Gordon Parks, who was the first black person to direct a movie about a black person's life. Think about it. How many movies existed before The Learning Tree that were stories about a black person growing up? Like, I'm going to tell my story of my life growing up in, he's in Kansas, Gordon Parks is. How many movies did you have before that? You had very few. You had Raisin in the Sun, perhaps, which is a play, initially, before it was a movie. So you have Gordon Parks who go and open the door for black people to direct films. He directed, produced, wrote the score, and was the writer of The Learning Tree. He had just as much power as Orson Welles did on Citizen Kane. And then, like, so we have to throw in Melvin too, because Melvin, he the story of 3 Day Pass, which I think is 68 or 67, he directed a movie in France in French, came back to America, and won an award and had to stay in a hotel where he was not allowed to stay in San Francisco when he was a cable car operator because they thought he was white. And also, he was the third black person asked to direct the movie. He made Watermelon Man. And then he made Sweet Sweetback, which for decades was the most successful independent movie ever made. This is 1971. So you went at 67 to 72. We got Sidney, we got Gordon Parks, we have Melvin Van Peebles. If we were going to push it a little further, we'd talk about Pam Grier and we talk about Tamara Dobson and Diane Carroll, not movie wise. Diane Carroll was more famous for some other things. She was the first black person to win a Tony, first black woman to
Oh,
win a
okay.
Tony. This is 1961, I think it was, when she won. So Diane Carroll's history, we think of her as Julia, we think of her as Claudine, we think of her as Dominique Devereaux, but she had a whole history before that. And one of the things I talk about in the book is people who had a history before they show up in my book. William Marshall, Blackula. He had done black stage stuff for 20 years before he was Blackula. Zara Cully, Mother Jefferson on Jefferson's. She had spent 50 years as the foremost authority on dictation and elocution. Black people came to her to learn how to speak. She was a director. She wrote plays for black people to do on stage. So all this stuff is happening, and we just don't talk about it. We just don't know about it because we're not told. And then they wind up in something like the Jeffersons. And then you don't realize that they had a whole history before that that is richer than the little sliver that we know.
No, and I think that's what's good about this book is that you do give this history. And as I said at the beginning, many of us start at the landmark book, pictures that we all know, the Shafts and the Mac. And then you go, oh, wow, I didn't realize there was all this stuff going on prior to it. Let's go back to Sidney Poitier for a minute. You talk about a trilogy of films that he did, Mr. Tibbs, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Each of those kind of move him in a different direction. And I think in many ways, knock down some doors. I said Mr. Tibbs, The Heat of the Night. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, there's a Mr. Tibbs movie. They call him Mr. Tibbs. That's a sequel to In the Heat of the Night. So you're not wrong.
And and what was the other one that came right before that? It was
Well, there's three Mr. Tibbs movies. There's In the Heat of the Night, which won the Oscar in 1968. There's They Call Him Mr. Tibbs, and there's The Organization. which is the trilogy. So Mr. Tibbs, Virgil Tibbs, is the first black character to have a trilogy of films. He precedes Shaft because Shaft had a trilogy afterward. But in 67, if you're talking about that, you have In the Heat of the Night, The Servant Love, and Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And to move those, you're right. In the Heat of the Night was a huge deal for Sydney, for black people in movies, because when Sydney slapped that white man, that was something you could not do in the movie. Norman Jewison, who directed In the Heat of the Night, talks about that in his book. He goes, you know, when he slapped that white man, he wasn't just slapping a rich white man. He was slapping, you know, white society. And you just didn't do that. A black man didn't hit a white man and get away with it in the movies before that. And then To Sir With Love is this, you know, big love poem to a teacher, to Sydney, who is an authority figure to these, you know, white kids that would be basically what the black kids would be in most other movies, these little, you know, run-down poor black white kids. And then, of course, Hollywood had to put Sydney back in his place, so they made Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. So Guess Who's Coming to Dinner came out in December of 67. The other two movies came out before that. And Guess Who's Coming to Dinner made the most money of the three movies I just mentioned. It's also Sydney in his usual role. He's so perfect, I said that he's so perfect that the Grand Duke Wizard of the KKK would let him marry his daughter. And he doesn't, and this person does not exist. That's the other problem. We weren't allowed to be complicated. And it's not Sidney's fault, obviously. You know, but we weren't, until he took control of his career, you know, he was a specific type of black person
But
that wasn't there to scare white people. Yeah.
in the heat of the night, he is complicated, though,
Oh,
wouldn't you agree?
absolutely. Yes, that's what I'm saying. That's when you were saying in 67 when things changed for him, that is exactly it. And The Heat of Night is a huge, huge turning point for Sydney.
You know, one of the things you touch upon, and maybe you can remind our listeners, Odie Henderson, who's our guest, these type of rules that existed, especially as you are in the era of segregation. I mean, 67's on the cusp of ending it, but prior to that, you know, black people are routinely edited out of movies, and a scene like what you talked about, him smacking a white man, did that play in the South? Because obviously in the six in the early 60s, I would imagine it wouldn't have.
Well, again, this is 67, and the South was against it. They didn't want to show the movie at all, period. Slap or not. In fact, they had to, Sidney refused to shoot in the South because remember, he and Harry Belafonte was killed delivering money down there. And so Sparta, it was supposed to be in Mississippi in the movie, and it actually was shot in Illinois. There's one scene that's shot in the South, a scene where he goes to stop the white man because there's no cotton in Illinois. So they had to shoot it down there. No, the South was against it. They would edit out like Lena Horne. That's why if you watch these movies with Cabin in the Sky and Stormy Weather Accepted, they would edit Lena Horne out. She would only show up, sing a song. Look at these movies. Black people show up, they sing a song, they tap dance, the Nicholas Brothers, there's something that is completely tangential to the movie because they could cut it out in the South. They couldn't cut Lena Horne out of Stormy Weather because number one, she's the star of it. They couldn't cut her out of Cabin in the Sky because it would have pretty much, the movie wouldn't have made any sense. But for the most part, they would cut you out. And some movies would not play in the South at all. And so at this point in time, in 67, there was a change, a shift. It was going to have to be because, you know, the black people, white people wanted to see Sidney. He was the number one box office draw. Black and white people wanted to see him. So yeah, they would. And some places in the South would not play in the heat of the night. No.
Okay, so they didn't edit it. They just wouldn't play it at
They
all.
wouldn't play it at all. No. Because I mean, there are other scenes in The Heat of Night that bother me. Lee Grant talked about how she touches Sidney. Remember, she's the woman who says he's got to stay on the case, and she reaches out to him and like she's in pain, she's like in grief, and she reaches out and touches him. Now, remember, you couldn't do that. Harry Belafonte and Petula Clark got in so much trouble because they sang a song together and she reached out and touched him. And NBC said, "We're not going to run this program." Harry Belafonte said, "If you do that, I'll never like sing on NBC again." That's how ridiculous it was in that time in the South. And then Hollywood catered to that.
So, but in the blaxploitation, as you point out, it was almost like an obligatory type of scene
Oh,
for the
yeah.
black man to sleep with the white woman. Was that an intentional, like, we're going to shove this in your face and slap you upside the head? You're going to like it whether you like it or not? Or was that just
Yep.
coincidence? Okay.
No,
It was.
Melvin Van Peebles talked about how much he hated Sidney Poitier's movies, and he made Sweet Sweetback as a huge provocation because Sweet Sweetback is this major stud that basically sleeps his way to freedom, inspiring a very famous Ebony article called The Emancipation Orgasm, which is well worth reading if your readers can find it. It's on Google. You can find it pretty easily. It's a fascinating article about what was going on in black, intellectuals' minds about blaxploitation, specifically about this film. Melvin Van Peebles wanted to make almost a parody. Like back in the day, like the black men, the bucks, they called them, McDonald Bogle called them, where the guys are going to go rape the white women or like have
Right.
sex with the white women and completely ruin them for white men forever and ever. Amen. Sweetsweetback is almost a parody of that. He's like, you want a super stud? I'm going to give you a super stud. And he says something like, don't let the people know that you're saying F you to them.
Right.
That's his quote. So basically, it's almost like we could not have sex in movies before at all. Now we're going to be screwing up and down the screen. Or we couldn't be, the hero of a movie. We couldn't survive till the end of a movie. Now, not only are we going to survive, we're going to be kicking a lot of people's behinds on the way to the end credits. So in a way, it's a kind of like a rebellion. And when it was an underground rebellion, it was a lot more effective. Once everything that becomes underground becomes mainstream, it is corrupted and destroyed, which is technically what happened to blaxploitation in some ways. But at that time, people don't realize how, I'm not going to say revolutionary because that's a bad word, but how much of a rebellion it was to do those things.
Was that a good thing that it did it open doors, so to speak, or did it just become kind of trite, or maybe even get a backlash?
Well, I think both. I think both things happened. Because if you look at it, if you're a black person and you're directing a film, you have some right to hire people of color. Melvin Van Peebles lied and said Sweet Sweetback was a porno because union people didn't work porn. And the union was all white, as you know, and there was no way to get black people into the union. There's movies about this, even back in the 70s about this.
Right.
So he made a movie because unions wouldn't work porn. He got a multi, racial diverse cast of people behind the camera.
So hold on
One,
1 second.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no. I think that's important. I want people to kind of understand that. And that's what I love about a lot of what you put in the book. That backdrop and that little fact changes a lot of things. So we're talking about people will say, in 2024, we need to have, black people behind the cameras, in front of the cameras, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And at that time, you had very limited opportunity because of unions and other things. And the workaround, as you're pointing out, is well, I'm gonna do an X-rated movie. And everybody's like, well, if you do an X-rated movie, we're gonna fall back. We don't want no parts of it. But
Right.
that in itself opens the door for the diversity that people were craving at that time. So that was kind of, and that was very intentional. That wasn't by accident, as you
No.
point out. He did that specifically to get folks in. So when he's doing this thing, that's you got to look at it in a, I've got to look at it in a much, much different way.
Right. So you have to look at it in context. I mean, again, there are stereotypical things in these movies, but you have to look at it in context of what's actually happening. Hugh Robertson, who edited Shaft, who Gordon Parks hired to edit Shaft, Hugh Robertson was the first black person to get an Oscar nomination for editing. And the movie he edited has no black people in it at all. It's Midnight Cowboy. Midnight Cowboy is very avant-garde-ly edited by Hugh Robertson, who eventually wound up directing a film called Melinda. So look at how this steps through. He does Shaft. He gets his directing job doing Melinda. Gordon Parks directs other movies. His son directs a couple of movies. You get some writers like Lonnie Elder to write movies. He wrote Melinda. He wrote a couple of other movies. You get Oscar Williams, who wrote Black Belt Jones and directed Hot Potato and did some other movies like Final Countdown with Billy Dee Williams. All these people are coming in. And granted, it's still a primarily white universe in Hollywood, but once you open it, Michael Schultz, another example, you get through the door, you're going to hire another black person. You're going to hire another Spanish person like John Alonso, the great Mexican cinematographer. You're going to bring these people in, whereas the white directors were not doing this. So if nothing else, this era ushers in, both on television and in movies, more people of color coming through the door. Now, a lot of times they got screwed over for money, but that happens, you know, it's been happening to us forever. Curtis Mayfield, like we got to mention Curtis, you know, went from the impressions to scoring a movie. Without Superfly, there'd be no Saturday Night Fever soundtrack. There'd be no Grease. There'd be no Flashdance soundtrack. Superfly and Sweetback were the first movies to promote their movies by putting out an album so they get name recognition. The fact that Superfly the album made more money than Superfly the movie, and Curtis got shafted. All those things he wrote, Claudine, Sparkle, Short Eyes, all the piece of the action, all those movies, Curtis, a writer, a score writer. And before that, you had Duke Ellington, you had Quincy Jones,
Right.
and that's it. See, now it's opening the door in a lot more ways. So there's good and bad. That's why I keep coming back to the fact that for all the negative things that happen in some of these blaxploitation movies, you have to look at what else is happening. And that's
Right.
why before each year, I come out and I say, here's what's happening in 1974. Here's what's going on outside of this bubble that my book is in. You know, Nixon is doing this. Stevie Wonder is doing that. Black people are doing this. I want you to set the stage for what is happening, you know,
Right.
because we forget that part,
And
you
for
know.
people who don't know, the way the book is laid out, it's year by year. And so you
Right.
go into depth. So you're reading about 1970, 1971, and each year in many ways can be a book unto itself.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of, you know, nooks and crannies that you can go through. I want to come back to, you know, Sweet Sweetbacks for a minute.
Okay.
And I want to look at a couple of angles to this. One, you get the Black Panthers, Huey Newton saying this is required watching for everybody.
Right.
And it kind of goes in line with it being a rebellious movie. I'm sure he gets it. The black man wins at the end. That's like, you know, one of the first times
Unprecedented.
you see this, right? And it's all these different things. At the same time, you have somebody who many of us admire. I admire him a lot, you know, the late historian Lerone Bennett, and
Yes.
he's going off
He wrote the
about why this
Emancipation Orgasm. Yes, he wrote the article I mentioned. Yes.
So how do these two kind of reconcile, or do they reconcile, or what does it really say? Because Melvin took some of these critiques hard
Oh, yeah.
and responded often to folks, and just, you know, in a nutshell, kind of wrote those folks off as bourgeois and
Bougie, yeah.
even bougie, and said they didn't understand the common black man. But man, when you're talking about Lerone Bennett, you know, he
Yeah.
ain't no rookie.
Oh, no, not at all. And then Clayton Riley and these other people I mentioned in the book, these are some, you know, big names of black folks who aren't, you know, well, Melvin himself was bougie. He said he was bougie. Van is his middle name. It's not, we think Van Peebles is his last name. It's not. His last name's Peebles. He grew up in Chicago, middle class in
Right.
Chicago. You know, he said, you know, his mother called him Van in middle name because she said it sounded aristocratic. But here's the thing, Lerone Bennett and Melvin and all these other black folks, you know, everybody got to hustle. And I'm not saying this negatively, I'm saying this positively and love in my heart that, you know, everybody has a little hustle here. And Melvin has his little hustle because he knows that any publicity he gets for his movie is good. And Melvin was a master at a side hustle. Look at what he did. He went to Paris, he learned how to speak French. Went to Paris, wrote three books, because in France, they would let you make your movie out of your book. They pay you. They pay for it. That's where the story of 3D Pass comes from. So he had to go out there and do this. This is a man who grew up in Chicago, was fired from being a Pullman porter in San Francisco, coming out and doing this. And what Lerone Bennett was doing was he's basically asking a question, not just him, about why are black people going to see these movies? We should know better about ourselves. Without taking the fundamental thought that I'm speaking from my own personal experience, when I saw Harlem on the screen, when I saw those in the Huff and things like Uptight, I saw my neighborhood. I saw what my neighborhood looked like. I saw people that looked like me, people that were having their own side hustle, people that were trying to make a living, people that were bad pimps and sex workers and drug dealers. All that stuff was in my neighborhood. And then the urban decay. One of the things that blaxploitation shows you is a time capsule of the decay of the black neighborhood. of like the, not just black neighborhood, but of urban environments at all. Like New York is going bankrupt at this point in time. You get a
Right.
time capsule of that, but you also are seen. That's the thing I kind of pointed out in the book, that no matter how negative some of these stereotypes were to the adult black person or to an intellectual, to me as a kid, I wanted to be John Shaft. He was cool. He wasn't, the Jeffersons weren't broke. The Jeffersons were the first black people ever saw money.
Right.
These things influence you good and bad, And so to me, it's kind of like, in a way, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword if you think about it, in that you're being seen, but also at the same time, there can be a corruption of that and make you believe that you should be the wrong type of individual. But that's not. Art's job is not to raise you as a kid. Art's job is to provoke you.
Yeah, but then we got to come back to what Lerone Bennett is saying in his article, that the most powerful medium is television,
Amen.
movies. And with that being said, a few things are happening. One, there was this resistance to see us kind of shine. Hence, anytime we did something, it was either going to be edited out or not included, et cetera, until you
Right.
start to get these movies to come along. But maybe let's shift gears, because I use this oftentimes in a class. And Ricky Vincent, who wrote the book Party Music, points this out. The role of the militant, and I look at Superfly, a movie that when I was younger growing up in New York, many of us who didn't see it, because we couldn't see it at that time, there was no YouTube and all that,
Right.
saw the pictures and immediately thought Superfly was a pimp. Wasn't until years later that I go, oh, he's a cocaine dealer, because he
Yeah.
dressed like one, so
Right.
that's one thing on it to itself. But at the time when I first saw it, he was the hero that smashed on the black militant, the Panther characters.
Right.
And I didn't really understand that, because I think, like you said, you wanted to be like Shaft. It's like we want to be like Superfly by the time we get a chance to really understand it. And this is years after the movie comes out
Right.
that we see this. But when you start to look at all these genres and see, like, well, wait a second, I'm in Oakland now. No pimp was going to ever run up on Huey Newton and those guys at that time
No.
and punk them down. That was just like would never ever happen.
It's
But this was
fantasy.
routinely starting to happen, where the militant is made to be a buffoon. And the argument has been made that we start to look at this anti-hero, or what the Panthers would have said is a counter-revolutionary,
Right.
as the hero. And Huey's no, just using him, he's no longer the hero, but Superfly is, or Goldie is. How do we kind of deal with that? Because is that a fault of black exploitation, or is there just other things in the backdrop that would move us in that direction?
Well, there are a lot of black exploitation movies that have militants in them who are heroes. I think that they do them wrong. I think that I talk about Uptight, which is made in 68, which is a remake of The Informer, the Irish
Yeah.
novel and book that Jules Dassin and Ruby Dee put in made. And I think that is one of the few movies that gives you a really good picture of the militants played by Raymond Saint-Jacques.
But you
And
also say that's the first one too, not to cut you
I
off.
think I'd say it's, I feel like it's the blueprint of
Right.
everything because it does everything in my mind correctly. Whereas movies like Shaft, even you have Ben Buford, who is a militant, who is the hero, I don't think they treat militancy with the militant nature that is needed. And when you do that, with something like The Spook Who Sat by the Door, the government snatches your movie. So think
Right.
about that. But there are a lot of movies, every black station movie has a militant in it. And a lot of times they're on the right side. They're maybe not
But
the
they're
hero, but
often
they're certain.
they're
Well, a lot of
but
times
they're
they're
off.
buffoonish, yes. And I think partially that is because they wanted to, look at what's going on at the same time. This is also happening in real life. They're trying to discredit the militants in real life, they're killing Fred Hampton. They're doing all these things that are happening to basically say the FBI and so on is that, we have to smash these people down before they have a revolution. And
Right.
so that's coming bleeding into movies in some of these ways, but I am not so sure that the true villains of Superfly in my opinion, this is why I said it was a Citizen Kane of Black Fiction, because it is shockingly amoral about this. In my mind, the true villain of Superfly is Youngblood Priest, who is the hero of Superfly. Because if you look at it, if you root for him, you're rooting for a system that is basically destroying the neighborhood. His capitalist migraine is destroying it because he wants $1 million. Even though he already has enough money to retire, if you will, he wants to make all this extra money. If you go against him, you're looking at the white folks in the system that is basically crushing him and forcing him to be a cocaine dealer. And then you got Curtis on the soundtrack confusing you even more because he's doing a counterpunctual narration on telling, you see all this good stuff happening in the movie, then you hear Curtis singing that Freddie is dead and Eddie, you should know better. So the Superfly is an incredibly complicated, complex movie, probably the most complex movie in the blaxploitation genre.
And
It's
also
a
one of the top, selling movies at that time, too.
absolutely. And Ron O'Neill and all those folks, even though Nate Adams is credited as the costume designer, most of the people brought those clothes out of their closet. That wasn't a decision by the costume designer. It was like, we broke, bring your clothes to it, and that's what everybody had on. And it started a fashion trend. I got a picture of me 3 years old with a Superfly coat and hat on that I show when I do these things and I do book signings. I show this picture of me. It's like my mother dressed me. I look like the pimp of the playground.
That's the voice of Odie Henderson, the author of the book Black Caesar, Foxy Cleopatra, The History of Blaxploitation. I want to come back with, because Superfly, in many ways, is it's a turning point movie. And even though you mentioned Uptight being the archetype, the archetype for these movies, it's in the 60s and many of us are coming of age or born in the 70s. And so we don't go back to the 60s. We see it there, in the 70s. And, as you get older, a lot of this is informed by the relationship and the dance that these movies do with hip hop, which is emerging, at that time. Some of the soundtracks, some of the movies, they're breakbeats. I'm remembering, Shaft and all these are breakbeats. Shaft goes to Africa.
Look at
We
the
could,
Black Caesar, the Black
yeah, Black
Caesar album
Caesar,
with the James Brown, the songs from, that.
So, coming back to this thing with the downplaying of the Panther types and the uplifting of the Priest and the Goldies of the world, it does inform people, I think, because many walked away, at least I remember growing up, folks wanting to be like Priest. The anti-hero, the destruction of the community, the cocaine dealer, but it was like, that's who I want to be like. And so now it comes to question, does Gordon Parks, who is incredible, with his work, the photographer, and very, very conscious, and as you mentioned, does the learning tree, but he's also the director of Superfly.
No, Superfly is directed by Gordon Parks' kid.
That's right, that's right.
So Gordon Parks Jr. directed
Yes.
Superfly and Thomasine and Bushrod and Three the Hard Way. These are Gordon Parks Jr. movies.
That's
Gordon
right.
Parks Sr. directed Shaft and Shaft's Big Score and Super Cop and a couple of other films that he did. He also directed, if I'm not mistaken, the first movie about Solomon Northup.
So does his son even, does he realize the thing that he's doing with the downplaying of the Panthers in those movies?
Well, he only made Superfly in that regard because Thomasine and Bushrod is a Western. It's like a Bonnie and Clyde with Max Julian and Vanetta McGee. And Three the Hard Way is, a crazy movie about them trying to kill all the black folks with poison in the water. So there's different movies. The militants are starting to become these people like detectives like Shaft or people like in Three the Hard Way, these rogue, powerful black guys that are coming to save black America. It stopped being the Black Panthers and started being these rogue agents of people. So maybe not necessarily making the militants buffoons, but basically changing the direction of who got to be quote unquote militant. And again, like I said, there aren't many you trust transitioning out of this going forward, and the rare thing you get something like, the Final Countdown or Spook Who Sat by the Door, it starts to become dangerous. And then you decide, I don't want to make a movie like that because it's hard enough for me to get my movie made. Ivan Dixon, a black man who was on Hogan's Heroes and Nothing But a Man, and in Car Wash, he directed The Spook Who Sat by the Door. It was edited by Michael Kahn, the guy who directed edited all of Spielberg's movies, from Indiana Jones on. So there were a lot of white folks that got to start in blaxploitation too, that went on to be
Right.
famous later on. I think you have to think about, I'm making a movie. How can I keep, the man's foot out of my butt? To use Melvin Van Peebles' comment. So, and also, I think it became less important in the minds of some of these movie makers. Like, again, if this started in 65, let's say, for example, as opposed to 70, we would have seen a much different take on Millis. And like, I go back to Uptight simply because Uptight started shooting right after Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Right.
The opening of Uptight is actual footage from the, procession. And
Right.
that you couldn't do anything that ballsy in the 70s because such a thing would not didn't exist. You didn't have that type of real reality thrust upon you. Not that there weren't any, uprisings and so on in the 70s, but look at what was happening. Wattstax is a great example of pointing out, here's a celebration of the Watts Uprising. We're going to do a concert, it's going to cost a dollar, and people can come and see it. This is in 73 when Wattstax came out. That's as close as you get to something that pulls a lot of our history into a movie like of this era.
Right. So, Odie, let me ask you this because we mentioned it, and this was going to be one of my questions. Chapter 17, you do talk about the spook who sat by the door. Where do we put this? You mentioned that if you go too militant, you go too hard, the government is going to step in. We've had Sam Greenlee on the show when he was alive, and he talked about the type of blackballing that went on with many
Right.
of the actors and all that.
Dixon
I don't know.
retired. He retired. Dixon retired.
So how do we look at this, and what message did it send? Also, I think it's also it's often overlooked that, the importance of the soundtrack, and in this one, the soundtrack was, oh gosh, I wanted to say Earth, Wind, and Fire, but it isn't. It's Who's the
No.
soundtrack? It's
See, I'm drawing a blink too. It'll come to me in a second, I'm sure.
it was right in the tip of my head. I'm seeing the credits. But anyway, it's a big group. So
Right.
again, folks, where I want to say Herbie Hancock, but it isn't.
No,
It'll come to me.
it'll come to us.
Go ahead. But
So,
how do we put, the spook who sat by the door, and what's the story behind it that we really need to understand?
well, Sam Greenlee, as you mentioned, he was a real person. He wrote this book. He really was a CIA agent. He was the first black CIA agent, just like that. And The Spook Who Sat by the Door is a great title because it serves a double purpose. Spook is a synonym for is a slang for spy. It's also a slang for, a racist term for black people. So him using The Spook Who Sat by the Door, using that word, is actually very clever. But he wrote a book that basically is a how-to manifesto for revolution. I read the book, and the movie ends in the middle of black people taking over the freaking country.
Right.
And if you talk about what Lerone Bennett said, how TV and movies are so powerful, this is a recruitment. Like, see these military movies when they recruit you for the Navy. This is, and he actually in the book tells you how to do this stuff. I mean, it's not like he's telling you half of it and giving you, half explanation of how to do this. He's telling you how to make a bomb. He's telling you what you need, the way you need to put it, because he had all that experience. He had all that. He was trained. So he took exactly, it's like in the movie, in the book, the same character took what he learned and decided to turn it against the government that taught him that. And that is, you can't do that. According to the white folks, you can't do that because what you're going to do is you're basically going to get a lot of, like, look at do the right thing. You're going to cause a riot.
Right. And this was scary. So
Well,
that's
scared the
what,
hell out of them enough to make them pull a movie.
yes. And so this goes to the power of film. They clearly understood you show this enough, there's going to be a comfortability of folks moving in a particular direction. By the way, it was Herbie Hancock that did
Oh,
it.
you're right. Okay. Yeah. That was the same year he did Death Wish. Death Wish is what put him on the map as a score person.
Right. So after this happens with Spook, does this move everything in a whole other direction in terms of blaxploitation?
I
Does
think
it send a
partially it
message?
does. I think partially it does. Because if you look at after 74, things really start to fall apart. Outside of Fred Williamson, who had his own thing where he was writing and directing Westerns and giving himself work, you know, I got to give Fred Williamson credit for that. You know, he was one of the big black, I hate to use the word auteur, I hate that word, but I'll say it, auteurs, making movies for himself and writing and directing them and putting them out. Not all of them were good, but regardless, he was putting them out, having them made. Everything started to become much more salacious and just downright, let's focus on everything negative about these movies. Before, there were things that are positive. There's always a positive message in exploitation. They sneak it in like putting the broccoli under the cheese. You
Right.
know, they sneak it in. And then it just started to be, let's just make all these stereotypical movies where it's just black folks killing each other and cussing and doing drugs. And then at the same time, we have these other movies where now we have to have these uplifting messages like Amazing Grace and The Piece of the Action, that movies that black folks don't want to see because they stink. They're just preachy messages. You want preaching, you go to church on Sunday. Tim Goldman said, you want to send a message, you call Western Union. You know,
Yes.
so there are these movies that will either be over the top stereotypical stuff or over the top positive messages that nobody was going to buy.
Right.
And those two things collided and basically started to
And
bring the downfall.
they also didn't have the artillery.
Right.
You
But
know, I mean, Superfly, you have Curtis Mayfield, you have Gordon Parks Jr., you have all these
Yeah,
things.
you have
And
actors who can act, yes.
right. And you know, going back to even Gordon Parks, I'm not even sure if people knew there was a difference at that particular time, you know, because Gordon's name was just so prevalent in
Right.
so many ways.
And
So,
his son was also a photographer. That's why that whole montage of
yeah.
Superfly of photographs, he took that. You know, also, you have for every Cooley High, which is a great movie,
Yes.
you have something like Amazing Grace, which is directed by Sonal Lathan's dad, and it stars Miles Mabley, and it's one of the worst movies I've ever seen. Or you have something like A Piece of the Action, where, God help us, Bill Cosby and Sidney Poitier are trying to make a movie that's this preachy, you know, with Shirley Lee Ralph, preachy movie about, you know, pull your pants up and these respectability nonsense. And to be honest with you, black folks didn't want to go see that. They wanted to see something like Sounder or something like Cooley High because it was well done.
Okay.
It wasn't because the message was positive and they didn't want to see it. It was because the message was positive and the movie was good. And
So what
word
I
of mouth, people, we don't, we, you know, we disavow word of mouth so much now. But back in the day, there was no Twitter. How did you know a movie was good, right? Somebody told you, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a reminder that maybe, you know, there's a lot of investment in some types of movies and not as much investment in others, you know,
It's
in
also
terms.
money,
Yeah,
you
that's
know.
what I mean. Yeah.
It's none of us talking money in terms of what Melvin Van Peebles famously said that Hollywood had an Achilles pocketbook. You know, if something made money, they wanted to make 50 million of the same thing. And
Right.
each of those movies is a degradation. Each iteration was a degradation of the quality of the original. Shone a light on black people existing without the, you know, gaze of white audiences.
You know, I want to thank you for joining us this afternoon. We've been talking to Odie Henderson. He's written a very thorough book called Black Caesars, Foxy Cleopatras, A History of Blaxploitation. And believe me, we only touched the tip of the iceberg and we only covered like three or four things, you know, Melvin and Pam Grier and Gordon Parks. And but there's so much more, a lot of richness to this book. And it takes you know, not just up into the 78 where people may say blaxploitation or that version of it ends, but he also contextualizes it and lets you know how millennials and other people feel about it. And Odie Henderson, how do we get a hold of you? What any last comments you want to leave our listeners with?
Well, I'm at the Globe, so it's easy to find me there at the newspaper. I'm also on Instagram, Odienator2, Odienator2. I got off Twitter years ago because I have since. I'm on Blue Sky, Odienator on Blue Sky as well. But Instagram, the newspaper, obviously you can email me there, or you know, find me on Instagram or Blue Sky,
There you have it. We're going to
or
take
even
a.
LinkedIn for that matter.
There you go. Odie Henderson, that's ODIE. And we're going to let you roll. Thank you for joining us. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back.
Thank you so much.